some work I did with my colleagues at Predictive Science in San Diego, and also with Carl Shriver and Pascal Saint-Hilaire. And when I came to Predictive Science, I never expected that I might be working on something like a comet, but we're traditionally a coronal modeling group. And in 2011, there was this really great set of observations of a comet coming well within the solar corona. So then it sort of seemed like a natural extension to ask, well, what can we learn about the corona, the corona's magnetic field and temperature and density structure by examining these sorts of observations? So just as a quick overview, a sun-grazing comet is exactly that. It's a comet with a perihelion very near the sun. So here are some pictures of sun grazers observed in coronagraph imaging. And I would really suggest you go to this great website operated by or ran by Carl Badhams at NRL, which really talks about sun grazers. And I think it's great. Sun grazing comets, the large ones had been observed for centuries, but really in the space age, when we launched coronagraphs to look at the sun, that was when we started seeing a whole lot of sun grazing comets. And I think I just checked a webpage today, there's over 2,300 sun grazing comets observed, and the large majority come from coronagraph imaging. And a lot of these comets, and particularly the Crutes family, which is the majority of these sun grazers, they are thought to be small fragments of a very large parent body that every time it goes back around the sun continues to fragment and spawn new families of small sun grazers. And the thing is, a lot of them, or in fact most of them, don't make it through perihelion. So the radiation and gravitational environment is just too much, and they fragment and completely sublimate and are no longer visible. And the coronal connection between sun grazing comets really came in 2011, and this was a paper by Carl Shriver, where in AAA EUV imaging data, for the first time we could see one of these sun grazing comets. And this was a small guy, and it came very, very close to the sun. And you could see this faint tail in EUV emission, and then it just disappeared, so it disintegrated. But this really set the stage for saying, hey, maybe we can learn something about the solar corona by looking at these comets. And so this sort of set the stage for Comet Lovejoy, which was a big brother to the one we saw in July. And in December of 2011, Comet Lovejoy came around. And here it is in LASCO data. And you see it go behind the sun. And then I think this sort of surprised everyone that it actually made it through perihelion. It wasn't the same afterwards, and it actually fragmented a few days later. But this was sort of a testament to the size of Comet Lovejoy. And here's a picture of the orbit here. It came within 1.2 solar radii of the sun, or 0.2 away from the surface of the sun. So this is really well within the solar corona. And why I'm interested is, well, there were some really great observations of this comet. So what I'm showing, I'll show here some movies. It was observed both on ingress and egress from perihelion by AIA, and then also perihelion was observed by the STEREO spacecraft. And these are just base ratio processed 171 images that show the tail. And so here you see it sort of going along. There's this striation forming. Something's going on here. Here's perihelion. This one looked really neat. Whereas the comet's going, you can sort of see that the tail, the ionized tail, sort of wiggle and oscillate about. And here's another view of perihelion here. And then also, as it left the sun, it was initially going down, and then it came back up again. So there's really a whole lot of rich dynamics going on with this comet tail. And really, this does seem to suggest that there's some other mediator as this thing is going by. And we think that's the magnetic field. And so just to take a quick set of stills from these movies to point out the features that we're interested in. First, at perihelion, there were these very conspicuous wiggles of the comet tail on the order of minutes. Then on ingress, if you think about, well, what are the radial directions, what are the orbital directions, the tail motion was actually the complete opposite direction. So this really does suggest that there was some alternate mediator. And then also on egress, there was a really nice example of where the tail was observed on the order of minutes, so it was short-lived, but then it transitioned to being very, very long-lasting. And I think Dean has looked at this. Basically, you can see it as long as until it disappears into the noise of AIA, pretty much. So this is on the order of many tens of minutes. So we weren't the first people to look at this nice, rich set of observations. In fact, there's a great paper by Paul Bryans and Dean Pesnell that really go over why the hell we even see a comet tail in AIA passbands. And the basic scenario here is that a molecule containing oxygen, and we think this is probably water ice, that's what dominates these comets, that was originally part of the comet is sublimated from the solar radiation, and it flows out from the comet. This molecule will quickly be photodissociated by the radiation, and then this neutral atom will quickly be ionized as it interacts with the coronal plasma. And then the reason we see it in AIA is that successive collisions with the coronal plasma will raise it through successive ionization stages until we start seeing emission lines in the 171 and other AIA channels. And so we see oxygen 5 and oxygen 6 for at least as long as those species are there. And also this paper just came out by Patrick McCauley. Definitely check that out if you're interested in a more observational analysis of the emission. But coming from predictive science, we're very interested in the role of the magnetic field, in particular the magnetic field in the corona. So just looking at these movies, you instantly come up with the hypothesis, well, the motion of this tail must be telling us something about the coronal magnetic field. And so the simplest way that you can start to analyze these observations is think about, well, okay, maybe the tail is moving along the magnetic field of the corona. So the simple model that we came up with is that in the inertial frame, this newly released ion will initially have the vector sum of its thermal velocity, its sublimation outflow, and then its orbital velocity of the comet itself, which is something like 500 to 600 kilometers a second. But now it feels the coronal magnetic field. So there's this Lorentz force that's going to gyrate around the field. So this will destroy the perpendicular component of the ion velocity, but leave the parallel component unmodified. And so then this, as this ion flows along the magnetic field line, it'll decelerate and thermalize with collisions with the coronal plasma. And this is how it successively goes through these ionization stages to be visible. But taking this simple model, of course, well, we can test this by using coronal magnetic field models. And so that's what we did in this work. So the first step of building a coronal magnetic field model is, of course, your boundary conditions. And working with Carl Shriver, we got one of his synchronic or flux evolution maps from their flux evolution model. And the main idea of this is that they evolved the magnetic field to really represent the conditions at the exact time of perihelion. And this line here, this is the radius of Comet Lovejoy from the sun, or the distance. And then here is the latitude overlaid over the magnetogram. So at perihelion, it was going right over these two active regions here. And then it went over to the quiet sun, both before and after perihelion. And then the next step, once you have the boundary conditions, is, of course, to build your magnetic field model. And coming from predictive science, we have a model we're very proud of, this 3D thermodynamic MHD model. And I show this sort of schematically here. Tibor mentioned it in his talk earlier today. But basically, you have your magnetic map, you choose your heating model, and then this is thermodynamic MHD. So we're solving the ideal MHD equation plus thermal conduction, coronal heating, and radiative losses. So this is a difficult computation. This was relatively large, so you throw it on a supercomputer. But then what you get out from that is a nice 3D MHD solution that has force balance with the thermodynamic and magnetic forces. And you get a solar wind solution, so velocity everywhere. And we hope that this model is more realistic. And with that, you can generate, from the temperature and density distribution, a synthetic observable. And so I show that here for this case we did for the comet. This top row here, these are AIA observations. This is 171, 193, 211, and 335. And then these are the synthesized observations from the model. And now this is actually 2 weeks before, because perihelion was on the backside observed by Earth. What you see, what's most important is that in the thermodynamic MHD model, we are actually getting temperature and density contrasts that we think are realistic. So the 171 looks very much different than the 193. And then here is a zoom in for all of the observations I showed you earlier. This is the field of view, just showing the 171 comparison. So we think that we're at least starting to do a good job of representing the density and temperature around the time of perihelion. So then the next thing you want to look at is, well, what is the magnetic field that we got out of this model? And so what I'm showing here, this is normal to the orbital plane. What I'm doing is drawing a field line at 1 minute intervals along the orbit of the comet. And the blue is closed field and the orange is open field. And so as it's coming in from left to right, it goes through the streamer region. And then at perihelion, it's going through these shorter closed field loops. And then as it's going away, there's sort of this smooth open region here. And so we wanted to take this magnetic field locally around the comet orbit and look at, or sort of make a prediction of what we think the comet tail would do. And so here, the top row, this is the local magnetic field, now as it would be observed from these different instruments. And so this is just a part of the field line. And then you can take that and take the velocity of the comet and dot that with the magnetic field and get an estimation of what you think the parallel velocity of the comet tail ions are. And so on ingress, we fold in the magnetic field orientation, and then you naturally predict this sort of southwestern motion of the comet tails. So that was sort of a nice result. And then as it's going through perihelion, there are these shorter closed loops, and they'll rapidly change their orientation with respect to the comet orbit. And so what you see here is these arrows are sort of going up and down, and that's really indicative of those wiggles that we saw in the observations. And then here on egress, initially the motion that we predict is down and then back up again, and that's qualitatively consistent with what we saw. So you can take this a step further to sort of make a fun visualization. I won't go into all the details of how we did this. You can see the supplementary materials in the paper, but basically you have the magnetic field and you know the orbit of the comet, and so you can propagate sort of a test particles that might indicate what we think the tail would do at each point as the comet is going by in the magnetic field. And so we take this prescription and then we can overlay that over the observations to make these movies here, which I'll show. So you have to choose the deceleration time scale, and I just chose one for to make it more instructive. But basically, as the comet's going by, you would predict this motion in this direction here. Let me show perihelion. This one's nice. So these test particles naturally wiggle about. So this is really sort of a fun way to visualize the magnetic field over the observation. And so what this is sort of telling you is that really the motion of the comet tail is telling you something about the magnetic field in the corona. And if you have some prescription for how you think the tail will go, so let's say parallel motion, this is telling you that you can actually test magnetic field models of the corona in really a unique way using this type of observation. And so that's one thing we looked at next. So here we have our fancy pants thermodynamic MHD solution. And then you can take the simplest way of calculating the coronal magnetic field, which is the potential field extrapolation. Now, in some regions, they're very qualitatively similar. But what we always find when we run our thermodynamic MHD model is that the current sheets, particularly the longer ones, look very different. And so it's sort of more stretched out and open than this big current sheet that you get with the potential field model. And so this is something we wanted to look at in the context of the comet observations. Okay. So what I show here, this is, again, the local magnetic field, the tail prediction. And then here is the potential, same thing with the potential field. And what you see is that the predicted motion of the tail is actually in the wrong direction compared to observations in the potential field model. So this is sort of a proof of concept that you can indeed use these the observations of Comet Lovejoy to actually test between magnetic field models. But of course, it's very sensitive to precisely where you get this streamer. So you probably play some games with the potential field extrapolation to get a better fit. And then the last thing we looked at was what else we could we learn from these observations. And one thing is the time scale for ionization will, of course, depend on the coronal density. And we don't expect a lot of these lower ionization stages of oxygen to really be present at coronal temperatures. So they'll disappear eventually. So this is telling you that the lifetime of the tail is, in fact, possibly probing the corona. And so what we looked at here, this is the temperature of the MHD model along the arc of the comet. This is a log scale, this is density. And so density is falling as the comet is leaving. It's hard to see in this projection, but the comet is going farther away from the sun from left to right. And then if you fold this density dependence into the time scales derived by Bryans and Pesnel, then you can actually see that you'd expect the time scale to go from short-lived to long-lived as it's going away. And that's sort of nicely lined up with the observation. So really, not only can you probe the magnetic field, but you can probe the temperature and density. And of course, we took the simplest approach of just looking at the parallel motion, but really, it's probably more complicated than that. So here is a zoom in of some observations right on ingress. And you see these nice little striations forming. And it also appears that some of these striations are moving backwards. So this is telling you that there's some maybe interaction between the comet and the corona that's causing these loops to actually move after it passes. But and And also, these striations could be probing inhomogeneity in the corona, because the time it takes for an ion to get a neutral atom to be ionized could depend on the coronal density. So, but this would all require much better analysis. And just as a quick thing that I'm excited about, and I think a lot of people are, is that we're expecting an even larger sun grazer coming at the end of this year. So that's Comet Ison. It'll come in late November. I think right now the prediction is November 28th. And this is a much bigger comet than Comet Lovejoy. But it's at least right now predicted to come a little bit farther away. So it might be probing a different region of the corona if we can see it, and I certainly hope we can in EUV. So I'll just throw up my summary. With this comet, you can learn about comet tail dynamics in a unique regime, and you can also probe the plasma state of the low corona. And definitely see our paper if you want to see more details. Thank you. Right, well, like I just suggested here, my initial thought when we were writing this paper was, this comet body is sort of sloughing off layers and layers in this really intense radiation field. So the sublimation rate could be very bursty. So that's one way to explain that. But it does seem sort of repetitive. And another way is if it takes a long time, or takes longer in a low density region for the neutral to become ionized, you could sort of stack up tail enhancements once they become ionized in higher density regions. So it could be inhomogeneity in the corona, or inhomogeneity in the sublimation rate, or both.